Hey folks, thank you for becoming a member of Cafe Insider. In addition to the new Cafe Insider podcast, we're sharing bonus material from my interviews on Stay Tuned with Preet. This is exclusively for you. Hope you enjoy it.
We're going to spend the first few minutes talking about the pronunciation of your name,
right?
Which I think I have some
authority. Let's see how you do. I mean,
I think I do okay.
Sometimes confidence can be debilitating.
I get more offended
of white people if you don't
like,
say it right.
Anand Giridharadas.
Preet, you're close.
That's not it.
You're close. Anand.
Oh no, right. Let's do it again. I know it's Anand. Anand Giridharadas.
You're getting so much better.
Is that better?
Giridharadas.
But the name that they mostly mispronounce is the last name.
Yes.
Right? Which I got correct.
Say it again.
Giridharadas. Okay. So
I should inform our listeners that Preet is literally checking his notes.
The ninth
right now,
A,
as they say
the
it.
Ninth A is kind of something.
Yes, exactly. The ninth A. I'm telling you, someone at a future event is going to come to me and say, I'm sorry I mispronounced your name, but Preet mispronounced.
Yeah, but they don't even
and he's
get,
Indian.
But most
so,
people don't even get close. And by
yes,
the way,
you were a 9.5.
I grew up with friends of the family named Anand, A-N-A-N-D.
Yes.
But you let people call you Anand.
I don't.
You don't?
I don't.
What do you call yourself?
Anand.
We go to Disneyland or wherever, you know, go to the novelty stores, and there was never a license plate that said Preet or Pretender on it, nor was there one for Anand. And maybe it's because of the name I have. Before I did press conferences to announce cases against people we believed were guilty of serious crimes, I tried to be sure I pronounced the defendants' names properly.
Right.
Like, I would ask the prosecutors if they knew for a phonetic. Right, because you should pronounce people's names.
Correctly. We should actually talk about this.
Yeah, okay, well, yeah.
I grew up never being mad about it, and it was actually just recently. I was like, you know what? This is actually important to where the country's right. going.
We've got a long time. Do you have another couple of minutes? Because I'm loving this. Do you have a? I hadn't thought of this question until just now, and maybe you don't want to say because you mentioned the Sackler family. Is there a model, quote unquote, plutocrat? You know, a model billionaire. Who is at least approaching, in your mind, the way one should live life and think about policy and advocate positions, given their wealth?
So the reason I avoid answering that specifically is here's what would happen.
Because you could get invited to that house.
Right. I would name someone, and then someone would pull up some tax return that showed that they did something that I didn't know about, other people didn't know about. I'm hesitant to use anybody as an example, but I get your questions. Let me answer it this way. I think there are all kinds of people doing what I call traitor to your class giving, right? So look, to be very clear, I believe in an America in which there are fewer billionaires and less billions to give away and less of a need to give billions away because we are solving more of our biggest shared problems through shared institutions, right? So cards on the table. I agree with you, but I think I hear in some of your questions that we're not going to get there tomorrow, and we may not get there in 10 years, and we may never get there. And I get that. So in the meantime, you got these people with this money, you got these problems. What I do not want to happen is for these people to solve these problems in a way that A, obscures their complicity in causing them, in B, that increases their plutocratic power over the society, thus exacerbating the underlying problem, even as they're solving some issues. What I would like to happen is for some of those folks to give in ways that actually accelerate the end of plutocratic capture and accelerate the advent of the age of reform that I believe is coming. So some examples. If you give to ProPublica as a rich person, invest nonprofit investigative news site, right? Like there is no payoff for you as a rich person. They're not putting your name on anything. They're not just knowing ProPublica. Like, they're not going to spare your friend because you did that, right? I don't think people really know if you give money to ProPublica the way, you know, you have it on a museum or something. And what is the kind of stuff ProPublica is doing? ProPublica is, like, busting your friends, people like you, your class of people. That's an example of a kind of giving that is not self-oriented, that is not self-aggrandizing, that actually seems to me about building a kind of society that's more just. If you give to organizations that are doing, we've talked a lot about tax policy, right? Virtually every question you ask me, I don't really fully know the answer to because these are intensive research questions, right? It would literally take $10 million to properly answer all the questions you asked about taxes on this podcast.
And
someone needs to fund that.
And who's going to fund that? It's exactly cycle of problem that you're
woke,
talking about.
First of all, I think there should be way more decentralized funding of those things, right? People can give $10 to those things the way they give to political campaigns. But yes, if there are woke billionaires listening to this, that's something you can do. You can fund the people working to think about a more just tax policy. And that's, again, traitor to your class giving. There are lawyers right now, you may know some of them, working to win a long-term Supreme Court victory, reverse an old Texas case, that would make it unconstitutional to fund public schools by property taxes, disparately, right? As you know, the odds of that are low, the way the odds of the marriage case were low. I mean, the odds of any kind of case like that are low. There's some lawyers playing a 20-year game to win that case. Yeah. I guarantee you those lawyers have very few resources compared to all the people working on other areas of education like charter schools and whatever. So give money to those lawyers. On each of these issues, there is real change and there is fake change. There is like lean-in change and there's like actual feminism. There's, you know, actual equitable public school funding and there's a charter school you can put your name on and tell your friends about. And so what I would encourage people to do, whether they are regular people or people with a lot of means, is to become clear. And that's what I've tried to help people do with the book. Become clear about what is real change and what is fake change. First of all, just become clear so you see the difference. And then spend your time, your money, your effort, whatever you have to give on real change.
Last tax question, because I'm fascinated by this. And this is an issue in which people feel very strongly. And I understand both points of view. On the one hand, if you get all your money from an inheritance, because your parents happen to be rich, even though you're born, you know, naked and unable to speak like every other child born in the world, you have a huge advantage over everyone else and you haven't earned a penny of it. So maybe there's an argument there should be 100% inheritance tax so that its life is fair for every newcomer to the world. On the other hand, if you believe in property, in the ability to transfer your own property, you know, blood, sweat, and tears in a hypothetical situation caused a father or a mother to establish some wealth, whether it's a lot of wealth or a modest home, why shouldn't you be able to, having already paid tax on it, on that income that helped you build that home, why shouldn't you be able to transfer the whole thing to the child? As a philosophical matter, I think it's actually very complicated. As a pragmatic political matter, it's less complicated and people don't like that tax. Having thought about these issues and inequality, what do you think about the transfer of wealth from generation to generation and the tax policy on it?
I mean, again, I think you can't ask these questions without asking what's been done over the last 30, 40 years, what has happened to the society, and what's the background conditions that you're trying to introduce a new policy into. So right now, one of the central problems in American life is that dignity and decency has become hereditary to an extent that rivals, you know, like feudal England or the caste system in India. That's not who we think we are, but it's where we're going. If you look at the data that I was talking about earlier. So if that is the situation in your society, right? If wealthy people are somehow entirely managing to transmit their privilege and people, you know, without that kind of privilege and wealth and racial privilege, et cetera, are unwilling, are also transmitting their disadvantages. And you don't really have functioning institutions in society that are breaking that up and scrambling things a little bit, then in that case, you probably need to do more on the inheritance tax. And you know, I would just say the inheritance tax is like part of a suite of what you need to do on inheritance. You also need to think about other forms of inheritance, right? So the fact that rich people are entitled right now in America to better public schools than poor people because of how we fund things through local property taxes in a way that other rich countries do not do, that's maybe a more important form of inheritance than wealth inheritance. Right? Locking everybody who most needs social mobility out of the same education that very rich people have, I mean, that's catastrophic. And that too is inheritance. You know, what we call meritocracy, that I think more and more writers and thinkers have started to illustrate, is this kind of its own type of merit-based aristocratic culture where institutions like the Ivy Leagues function more and more to help upper middle class people perpetuate their status. We need to think about not just an inheritance tax, but how do we avoid the trajectory we are on now in this country, which is to becoming an inheritance society?
Does it upset you when people use the phrase, they must say this about you, and I want you to give your cogent response because I think it's silly, and on this point, not even knowing what your answer is, I'm going to agree with you. When you talk the way you talk, people will say, well, you're engaging in class warfare.
What is class warfare?
Because I don't know. I don't know what people mean by that. But
here's the thing. If class warfare means that I am against the hijacking of the American dream and of the future of the planet by a few hundred thousand people, then deal me in.
Here's what's sort of interesting, right? In this country, and maybe it changes over time, and there's a lot of, I think, animosity that sometimes gets stoked appropriately, sometimes for political gain, on the part of people who don't have a lot against the people who do have a lot. Because there's a distinction between people who have a lot because they inherited it, and by cheating and being scoundrels, and other people who I think will stipulate some people make their money honestly and maybe they're not doing enough with it. That's a separate matter. But there are some people, it could be a baseball player or it could be a singer who just has a lot of talent. I mean, I think Oprah Winfrey earned her money. Let's talk about policy for a second. Look, one of the most direct and simple and most efficient ways to change income inequality and to address some of these issues we talk about is tax policy. Do you have a view on what the ideal tax rate should be?
I don't. I mean, that's a technical question that, frankly, like that a lot of people. But
should it be close to 80% or should it be close to 30%?
We got to tax a lot of different things more. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I am too inexpert in it to know like which of those we should lean the most on. I think both the Warren and Sanders wealth taxes are very good ideas. I think you could even push further on that, in my view. When you're frankly taxing such a small group of people, the notion that you'd do anything damaging to the entire economy is sort of laughable. I have been to those people's houses in the Hamptons. I know nothing would happen if they had one fewer of those houses.
Why are you going to those people's houses?
I haven't gone recently. Let's put it that way.
have your invitations dried up?
It's so funny. I was put on this list recently, the town and country's most desirable, most coveted dinner guests of 2019. You know, they portrayed it as like I was being invited, you know, and they were like, right, he's like our greatest skirt of the rich and powerful. Please seat him carefully. But I love the notion that town and country thought that I was still being invited to these things, which I am not.
Do you miss them?
I do not. You know, I think on the tax issue, I think we should very seriously look at a wealth tax, which is frankly a new concept in a lot of this political discourse and the big thing this electoral season.
But are you looking at a wealth tax because you think for general redistributive purposes or because there are things in the country that can't otherwise get done, like universal health care or free college or those sorts of things, and the only way to get that money is to take it from these folks?
It's a very good question. I actually think that's important in that there's a bunch of big ticket things we need to do to fix the American dream and save the planet that you probably wouldn't be able to afford without it, but that's not the reason. I actually think in and of itself, even if we were already doing all that stuff, these fortunes should be made smaller for democracy to thrive.
What you're describing with respect to the art world, I'm guessing, I'm not an expert, reveals another fundamental problem, that there's not enough money to fund art. There's not enough money to fund certain kinds of art, like opera, for example. Drama does fine because you have Broadway and people are willing to pay money. But unless there's subsidization of certain kinds of art, we just won't have it. So
but again, think about that assumption. I think that's true. But there's two things that are left off the table there. First of all, as in many societies, you could have more public funding of the arts.
No, sure. But
right?
We don't have
a filmmaker.
That. Yeah, we don't have that because
well, we don't have that because the same people don't want to be taxed.
It's a lot
right?
of, well,
it's the same money. It's the same money that could be in the government.
Well, I don't know about that. I think there's also cultural wars that go on, and there have been repeated campaigns by Republicans in particular, running for president and other things, who say we don't want to fund that stuff because they don't agree with the content of the art.
Right. So, which is why I think actually government funding the arts is a problematic thing if you don't create the right structure. Although you have the BBC, you have like Canadian giving money to films but, like, in a way that have the right safeguards.
You know, there's some things in the world that aren't, that the markets don't.
Correct.
And I think you believe this to be true. And we talk about it in terms of education. It's also true in art. And so the trade-off is, well, you could have government fund it, and then there's certain kinds of art you're never going to see because it's going to be offensive to some people
and
who are running for office.
I'm not advocating that only government funds, but let's talk about your opera example. This is a very good example. So you may say, okay, we got this opera in Louisville, Kentucky, and it's struggling the way many of these opera companies are around the country. I'm making this up. I have no idea if there's opera there. And you may say, you know, in an ideal world, XYZ, but right now we got this one rich guy and he'll fund it. We'll put his name on it. We'll do it, right? And so again, if you say, let's put the gun to your head on it, then like, do you not want this guy to save the opera? If the question's framed that way, then yeah, you probably want that guy to save the opera. But a couple things. That guy or people like that guy may have pushed for a world in which public funding of the arts was made less possible. So we just talked about that. But it's not just that. The way that guy employs people in Louisville may have created a world in which there's way less purchasing power among regular people to go to the arts. And so the opera company, to just game this out further, becomes less and less reliant on having to be relevant in that community and sell tickets, invent productions that actually are relevant to people and get butts in the seats, because people just don't have that kind of disposable income because of how they're paid and because of how the society works, in part because of rich people like that. And then you say, getting to a place where regular people can't afford the opera hasn't innovated because it doesn't depend on regular people anymore, the government has no arts funding, then you say, well, I guess we got to go to Jerry to get that $500 million. Yeah, absolutely. Like, at this point, call in Jerry. But let's not ignore the fact that Jerry and his friends did a bunch of things to create the conditions in which they would become saviors.
That was great. I hope you hope you enjoyed that. That was a lot
of fun.
That
was really fun. Really fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks again for becoming a member of Cafe Insider. Listen to the Cafe Insider podcast every Monday with me and Ann Milgram, and stay tuned every Thursday.